top. I live upon morsels you happen to drop, and coffee that somehow leaks out of your cup. If nothing comes down, then I'm forced to swim up. On the way upwards, the colors come back, but all on the bottom is blue, gray, and black. The darkness is cold, and perception goes wrong, and the night seems to go on incredibly long. So I ask you why. Pantomime mixtures of heaven and earth, jumbled events that have less than no worth. Time in the forest to dig under rocks or float.
Hi, everybody. We are live. I am very high energy for some reason. I don't know why. I should not be, because I had an early morning, and it's been a long day.
How much coffee have you had today?
I actually, so I normally do two cups. My afternoon cup was only a half-calf coffee selection. So, actually, I've had less caffeine than usual, but I don't know.
When is your afternoon coffee? Is that literally just, like, afternoon, or is it, like, 3 p.m.? Like, what is your coffee cutoff?
This is really boring. In most days, it's, like, 1:30 p.m. Today, it was 3, just because I was busy doing stuff until then. But
well, that could be why you're higher energy. You had your last, even though it was a half dose, you had your last dose at 3 p.m., so.
So, I think I actually might be wearing out my MacBook Air keyboard.
What? Are you using it that much?
Yeah, so I really am. So, because I keep going, you know, I'm doing restaurant stuff, so I'm on the ferry back and forth. I go to the city sometimes, I'm on the train back and forth. So, in all these times, you know, if I'm traveling, like taking a weekend trip somewhere, I'll take just the Air. So, I'm actually using it a lot. This is the M2 Air that I have. So, I'm using it a ton, actually. But the V is no longer very good. Well, no longer airy good. The command key is starting to go now too. The one that's nearest to the V.
But we were out of this phase. We got rid of the butterfly keyboard. These keys are just supposed to work. I thought maybe you were talking about your alien style acid blood / finger secretions that are wearing off the paint on the keycaps. But no, you're saying you press the key and the letter doesn't appear on the screen.
Yeah, like I gotta like press it harder, and I keep missing pastes.
That's no good.
I know. It's like, and I don't know. Are these easy to repair these days? I have no idea.
They can. You can bring it in, and they'll, you know, take off the little keycap and put it in a new scissor switch or whatever. But I'm hoping it's not. I'm hoping it's just the plastic mechanism that makes the keycap go up and down, and it's not the little switch that's below it that the key hits.
Yeah, God knows, because it's out of warranty, like by a pretty good amount now.
We see what you're doing here, Marco. I know the M4 MacBook Air is coming out soon. You know, you're sort of like laying the groundwork for why you, of course, need to get an M4 MacBook Air.
Honestly, so, okay. There are two things that would make me rationalize that very quickly that I think are plausible. Like, cellular, I don't think is plausible yet. That would do it no matter what. Because,
amen.
God, another, like, I had to reboot my phone yesterday to make it work on the ferry, like, as a tethering source. Like, there have been so many times in the last few months that I use tethering at least once a week, usually more, and I'd say maybe 4 times in the last few months I've had to reboot either the MacBook Air, the iPhone, or both to get tethering to work. Like, it's so buggy. But anyway, what would make me upgrade, like, sight unseen, would be a significantly brighter screen, because I'm often using it in sunlight, or a nanotexture option. Like, if either of those come to the Air, which I know that's not really an Air thing. It's more of a MacBook Pro thing, and the MacBook Pro is now
doing
that.
I can see them doing the nanotexture, since it's pretty cheap now, right? Like,
Yeah, it was a couple hundred bucks on the laptops. Like, it's,
yeah, it's nothing compared to the SSD upgrade prices they have on the MacBook Air.
I know, but I could also, like, it wouldn't surprise me if they keep that as a MacBook Pro only feature. Yeah. So I don't know, certainly I would love nanotexture and more brightness because I am often using it like in a sunny train window or on the sunny ferry, like, and so it that would actually get me to upgrade.
Yeah, I had to wave my dad off from his Mac can't run the current version of TurboTax, so that is what's triggering his need to upgrade. He has a 10-year-old MacBook Pro, and he can't run the latest version of TurboTax because it's tax season. So it's like, well, it had a good run, 10 years, and I was recommending what he should get. I said, don't buy a computer because the M4 MacBook Airs are going to come out, and that's what you should get, blah, blah, blah. And he's like, MacBook Air? Why not MacBook Pro? And I explained to him what the differences are, and I basically asked him, the only thing that will be relevant to you is if you think your current screen is not bright enough. Because if you think your current screen is not bright enough, a MacBook Pro will have a brighter screen. I didn't think about the idea that the MacBook Air could have a brighter screen, but I really doubt it's going to have a 1600 nit HDR, you know, MacBook Pro screen. But he said he was fine with the brightness, so I told him to wait, and he's going to get the M4 MacBook Air when it comes out. But you, I can imagine if you're using the thing on a ferry with the sun coming in through the window, a brighter screen would definitely help. But a non-functioning key on the keyboard would probably also make you buy one.
Well, it depends on, like, what will it take to get this fixed? Because, like, the error rate of the non-functioning key and the fact that it's traveling to the command key now, like, the error rate's going up. And so it's starting to get really annoying. So, if it's going to be, if it can be a quick, easy fix, maybe I'll get it fixed. If it's going to be, like, you know, a $600 fix, there's no way I would do that. So
They can do the keycap for you right in the Apple Store. I'm not sure replacing the keycap will fix it for you, but they can definitely do that for a very small fee while you wait, probably.
I hope so.
All right, let's do some follow-up. We had a little bit of follow-up with regard to John's example of single-user iOS apps. You know, I think that was way too much preamble. I'm already starting off strong. Hello, Future Marco.
Hi.
It was too much. Let me just reboot that whole friggin' thing. Hi, bootleg people. This is what we take your hard-earned money for, is me screwing things up. Let me try that all again.
Bye.
All right, let's do some follow-up. Stephen Klink writes, I liked John's example of Flighty as an app that doesn't need to involve other people, but wanted to note that one of my favorite features is the ability to share a Flighty card with anyone via a simple URL and have them see the exact same info as me. No app required, not even an email address verification code. That's a great point.
Good Flighty point. Even does that part well.
Yep. I mean, it's a great app. It really is. If you fly in an airplane with any regularity whatsoever, you should definitely check it out.
You pick up people at the airport who are flying an airplane, get the app anyway. That's the main thing I use it for, is when picking up other people at the airport. I'm not the one flying, but still, the app is invaluable.
Yep. I think all three of us give it our official 2 thumbs up. With regard to Apple Invites, Jim Weinert writes, my birthday is coming up. Happy birthday. So I thought I'd try out Apple Invites. Even if you can easily log in without an Apple account, my Android friends cannot figure it out and are giving up. Invites creates different links when I invite someone via their phone number or email. Why can't it use unique links to authorize attendees? Of the 12 people attending my birthday, only 3 people, 2 Android, 1 iOS, have gone through the hassle of RSVPing in the app. Everyone else has just texted me back. I'm so annoyed that I want to write my own invites app.
I don't think that's the solution, but yes, this is the danger of foisting technology onto other people in your life who just want to do a thing that they think does not necessarily involve technology. They can tolerate it if it works well enough that it doesn't get in the way, but the second it is not perfectly easy and seamless, it's like, oh, I'm just going to text the person.
Yep. Couldn't agree more. All right. With regard to Sidecar, we have a little bit of feedback from Matt West. I'm a software engineer at Google, and while it is discouraged, though not altogether forbidden, to sign into one's corporate Mac with a personal iCloud account, it is possible to use Sidecar on a personal iPad over a USB-C cable. I don't know why I didn't think of that. It's a great point.
I didn't even know it worked over USB-C. I've always just done it wirelessly, but that's cool.
Yeah.
Yep. All right, John, you have manifested something, and it's a real boon for a lot of the old-time Mac users. Do you want me to do this? Or do you want to take your celebratory lap?
Well, I'll let you do it, but let me just preface this by saying that even though it seems like I complained about a thing on a podcast and then the next episode Apple like did something about it, which has happened frequently in the past, this is absolutely a stop clock is right twice a day phenomenon. I've been complaining about this for decades. Like, if you just complain about something every single day, eventually something happens to address the thing you were complaining about. And I was like, oh, look, you're complaining worked. if you just, you know, it's kind of like that thing where you tweet that every single team won the World Cup and then you just delete all the ones that are wrong. Well, maybe it's not the same as that. It's more like a stop clock. But anyway, I take no credit for this other than the credit due to everyone who has been complaining about this exact issue for, I think, 25 years Apple IDs / Apple accounts have existed. It just so happened that one of the very regular times when I and other people complain about this happened to be last week. Since last week and now, Apple has finally actually done something to address it.
Yeah, this is one of those things that, like, I bet this was a huge pain in the butt for them.
Mm-hmm.
And this, like, no manager is ever going to advance their career by doing features like this.
Mm-mm.
But God, it was so necessary. It took 25 years
to get done.
Yeah.
All right, so what we're talking about is migrate purchases from one Apple account to another Apple account. A reading from the Knowledge Base article, which will be linked in the show notes. If an Apple account is used only for making purchases, those purchases can be migrated to a primary Apple account to consolidate them.
Now, let's pause right there, because I read this when it first came out. I'm like, what are they saying? Are they saying if you have an Apple ID that you've only ever used to make purchases, then you can migrate them? But what if you've used that Apple ID for something other than making purchases? Like, it's so weirdly phrased, and we'll get into the limitations inherent in this, but it's like, what I was complaining about last week was the ability to merge Apple IDs. This is not really that, but this is the major part that people want, which is, hey, I bought stuff on one Apple ID, but I have another Apple ID, or I bought things on two Apple IDs and I want to combine them. There's a lot more to an Apple ID than just stuff that you bought. There's all your data. There's all everything having to do with the history of that account. Truly merging accounts would be very big, but this article and this feature is clearly focused on just purchases. And the way they word it makes it seem like if you have this account where you've never done anything except buy stuff, then you can transfer them. That's not really the case. You can transfer them no matter what you've done on an account, but a lot of that stuff that you've done is not going to come. Only the purchases will be transferred.
And by the way, this feature isn't available to users in the EU, United Kingdom, or India. So, tough noogies. You can choose to migrate apps, music, and other content you've purchased from Apple on a secondary Apple account to a primary Apple account. However, it's worth now I'm not reading anymore, but there are a lot of limitations here, and let me read from the Knowledge Base a smattering of limitations. Neither Apple account can be a child account created through family sharing. Neither Apple account can already be used for migrated purchases. You can actually undo a migration of purchases, which is kind of surprising. If you undo a migration of purchases from secondary account, you won't be able to migrate purchases again for a year. You can't migrate purchases if both the primary Apple account and the secondary Apple account have music library data associated with each of them.
That's a pretty big one, because now it's like, okay, well, I want to migrate purchases, but if you ever like had music library data associated with one, like if you have like basically an iTunes library on both of them, you can't transfer stuff? Like, isn't that... That's kind of what they were getting at, and like, if you've only used it for purchases, that seems like a big limitation. Like, just I know they're not going to try to merge the music library stuff. Fine, like they're just trying to transfer purchases. But it's like, well, I'm sorry, both of these Apple IDs have music library data associated with them, so now you can't transfer stuff. Ugh, yuck! That is one of the worst limitations.
You can't migrate purchases if you've set your Apple One subscription to provide iCloud storage to a third different account. If your primary account has never been used for purchases or free downloads, you can't migrate purchases. I think the implication there is because you don't have any to migrate.
No, it's the other way. It's the primary account. It's the one you're migrating them to.
Oh, my bad.
That one has to have been used to do stuff, which makes some sense, but still is a little bit meh.
Oh, I didn't catch that. That's a good call. Thank you for the clarification. Neither Apple account can be receiving any special access to apps or content. For example, an Apple account enrolled in the VPP program. What is that? Volume purchase program? The volume purchase program. through an employer to receive special access to apps. And then, as a lot of people found out shortly after this was released, you also lose all your test flight enrollments. And apparently one of the things that you're shown when you do a migration is... on screen, it says the following will not be migrated to the primary account: personalized recommendations, digital project reviews, and test flight access. And then it continues, access to test flight won't transfer to the primary account. To continue using test flight, sign in with the primary account and request beta app access again.
If only that worked, Icon Factory is finding out that you can't just request access from the primary account, because when you try to enter it, test flight says, oh, you can't enter that person. They're already registered. And if you delete them, doesn't help because when they try to register any, like it thinks like both email addresses or both Apple IDs are associated with the same thing. So whichever one you try to register with, it thinks they're already registered, including after you delete them. So some bugs remain. So a lot of people are looking at this and like, finally, I can do this big transfer. And unlike iCloud Photo Library, where I pretty much did it on day one after messing with the betas, I would recommend people wait on this one. Because this feature did take 25 years or so to arrive. It is extremely limited. It has a lot of caveats. It probably has a lot of bugs. Maybe let other people go first. You've been waiting for how many years for this? You can wait another month just to see. Let Apple shake out the stuff. Because this stuff, like messing up purchases and other things associated with your Apple ID, historically have not been fun or easy or sometimes possible to get fixed. You can call Apple support. You can go through all the different levels. You can, like, you're just, can somebody, like, I bought this movie. Can somebody make it work again? A year and a half later, maybe someone will do something about it. Like, it's not the type of thing where you can just fix stuff easily. You can't do it yourself because they're Apple servers. And then getting Apple to fix their server stuff is incredibly difficult. So maybe just chill on this one. If you've been able to sustain your current split environment with multiple Apple IDs, keep these limitations in mind so you don't accidentally trip one. Like, don't accidentally make an iTunes or make a music library on one of the accounts or whatever. But maybe let some other people go first and see how it works out for them before you transfer stuff. So anyway, I applaud Apple for doing this, but I don't have a lot of faith that it was done as well as it could have been. Certainly, it is not the merging of Apple IDs, which would be a union of all of your stuff, which would be incredibly difficult. But again, 25 years is a long time, and Apple has a lot of money, so I feel like they should have been able to do it. But transferring purchases, it's a good start. Maybe in a year, it will be ready.
So you haven't tried it yet then, huh?
I don't have things to transfer. I do have multiple Apple IDs, but one of them is my developer Apple ID, which I've only used for, I think that was my original Apple ID, and the only reason I had it was to register for developer discounts back before it was an email address, back in the day when you'd subscribe for ADC Premier, and you get a free ticket to WWDC and a hardware discount that was tremendously huge that I used to buy like my Power Mac G5 and a Cinema Display. That's the era that my original Apple ID dates to. And then I got another Apple ID when iTools came out. And I have other ones for testing and stuff or whatever, but those are the two main ones that I use. But there is nothing on my developer account except for developer stuff. So my WWDC ticket, all my apps, blah, blah, blah. That's my developer account. All of my personal stuff is on my personal Apple ID. All my movies, all my music, TV shows, all that stuff, all the apps. So I don't have anything to transfer.
Fair enough. All right. We got a handful of people who, I don't know why people are so grumpy about Marco and I's desire to have a cellular Mac, but people are maybe not grumpy, but they seem deeply confused that this is something that we would desire.
Well, and, like I said, they haven't been convinced because they haven't ever been in a situation where they've seen what a difference it makes. Like, it's not the end of the world. Like, you can get things to work. Marco can reboot his phone. He can reboot his laptop. It will eventually work. But if you haven't experienced how much nicer it is not to deal with that, it just seems like not that big of a deal. All the doubters will be convinced when Apple finally ships this.
Yeah. And the thing is, like, I don't, like, when people tell you in tech, I need capability X, I need this. Here's why I need this. I need this. If you respond by saying no one should need that, that's not a helpful response. Like, I don't know who needs to hear this. Apparently everyone. But like, you know, if someone is telling you, especially like, look, Casey and I, like, we know computers pretty well. Like, I'd say it's safe for us to say without any modesty, we are computer experts. We are pretty good at computers. So when we say we want you know, tethering, or we want a cellular modem built in so we don't have to use tethering because tethering is not working well for us, I think we know how to, like, I think we can say with some credibility, this is what we actually want. So right? For people to come and say, you don't want that. Why do you want that? That's stupid. No one should need that. That's what you're saying is you don't want that. Or you don't think you want to pay for that, maybe.
Well, that's different. A lot of people are writing in have another solution that they say, why don't you just do X? I'm doing X. I think it's fine with me. I'm solving the problem in this other way. If you two only tried this other way that I'm recommending, you wouldn't want this anymore. I think that is the more common one, which is, you know, again, assuming that you either have never tried the thing that they're doing or that if you did try it, you would find it satisfactory.
Yeah. So a lot of people wrote in and said, hey, why not use a hotspot, man? You should just use a hotspot. A hotspot will fix all your problems.
See, that's the thing. A hotspot is all my problems. I have been using a hotspot because that's the only option. So trust me, when we tell you, we have used... are you talking about like the hardware?
A separate hardware.
And I believe you have used one. Didn't you bring one of those like Verizon hotspots to WWDC one year?
I've had two of them. Yeah, back in the day, I had like a USB stick, which was awesome. But right now, there are those standalone, like basically little tiny Wi-Fi routers with cell modems in them.
And don't drain your phone battery because it's got its own battery.
Right. It has its own battery to drain and to keep charged. I actually currently own one of those. I bought it for a trip 2 years ago or 1 year ago. And I've been using it since then as a backup internet connection as for my home internet. They are fine. In certain ways, they're better than tethering. In certain ways, they're worse. They are not as good as built-in cellular. And the main reason why is because, once again, it is a separate device that requires you to, first of all, carry it. Second of all, the data plans on it are actually very expensive. Like the AT&T ones, I think what I pay is, I think, $50 a month for that. And I think that's actually an older plan that's no longer offered, and now they're even more expensive, something like that. So, like, and they're like, you know, limited data caps and everything. Like, they're not great plans. And obviously, this will vary by carrier and country and things like that. But like here in the U.S., the plans for those are not amazing. At least if you want decent coverage. So sorry, T-Mobile people, that's not going to work for me. But anyway. Separate plan, and it's an expensive plan. Now, granted, whatever they would offer on a computer. Maybe it would be the same plans. Maybe it would be something between the iPad plans and that. I don't know. Whatever corporate laptops have, I'm sure it'd be the same plans as that. I don't know, like the handful of corporate laptops that have built-in cell modems. I don't know what they charge, but I'm sure that would not be that different. But it is a separate device that you have to carry, and they're not small. They're the size of like, you know, basically like a tiny Wi-Fi. You know,
a deck of cards.
I'd say mine is like. Two decks of cards, or like, you know, maybe like a novelty deck, like a large print Uno or something. Like, so they're not small, and it's just one more thing to charge, and you have to like turn it on, and as long as it's on, it is using power and draining itself slowly. So like, yeah, I could put it in my backpack when I'm gonna like, you know, go on the ferry for the day, but I still have to like remember to go reach in there, turn it on. It's gonna take up space in there. I have to make sure it's charged before I put it in there. And then am I going to remember to turn it off when I'm done, like when I arrive? And then what if I accidentally leave it on all day and it's dead? Like, it's another thing to manage. And that is better in the sense – it's better than tethering in the sense that the laptop will indeed connect to it fairly quickly because it is basically broadcasting a tiny Wi-Fi network. So the laptop treats it more like Wi-Fi. So that's good. But it comes with all those other burdens that I'm not sure are worth it. Like – This should tell you something that I literally just said. I own one of these devices, and I don't bring it with me for my like daily ferry trips because it's too much of a hassle.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. So I had realized. I'm pretty sure I talked about this on the show. I realized a while back that at my local library or libraries, which they're all incredible, and I'm so lucky to have them. But one of the things they offer is you can check out a hotspot from the library, and you get it for, you know, 3 or 4 weeks, and you pay nothing for it. And when you're done, you bring it back. And our library in the county in which I live, they distribute T-Mobile hotspots, which are okay. They're physically, you know, the devices themselves are clearly a little bit older, and T-Mobile coverage is okay. Then there's a neighboring county that's like a 20-ish minute drive from where I am. And they actually offer, not only do they offer reciprocity with you know, card holders from my county, but they also offer Verizon hotspots, and they're a little bit bigger, but they're way more modern and they work really well. And so this is relevant because I tried my darndest to make sure I had a hotspot available for football tailgates, because if you recall, I did that whole tailgate tub thing, and I have a portable router in the tub, which, yes, I know that's a little redundant. We're not going to talk about it right now, but there's reasons. And what I'll do is I'll plug one of these Wi-Fi hotspots via USB into that travel router to distribute internet. And it is nice and convenient, but I echo everything that Marco said. It is not as convenient. It is one more thing to manage, both physically and charge level. It's not small, particularly the nicer Verizon one is quite a bit bigger than the T-Mobile one. The T-Mobile one really is like a deck of cards, but I concur with your assessment of the Verizon one. It's, you know, like a couple of decks, or, you know, a big deck of Uno or something like that. And no matter what, it's one more thing to worry about. And I think I would feel very differently if I was doing like long car trips with the children all trying to use iPads or something like that. And that's where something like, you know, a little MiFi, they're often called colloquially, but one of these little portable hotspots, that's where it shines. But I don't care about that yet. Maybe I will in the future, but not today. And today, what I want to do is I want to open my laptop and have it be immediately connected to the internet. And that is, and not have to worry about any freaking thing else. And that's not a hotspot. So this is what I want. I want a cellular Mac. That's what I want. Ryan Powers writes, why does anyone use Sonos app in the age of AirPlay 2? I have two identical Sonos setups in my primary and guest bedrooms, a TV with a Beam and IKEA Symphonisk, I think I'm pronouncing that right, surrounds. I also have a few Sonos Ones in our kids' rooms and a Sonos Move. I'm a sucker for Sonos and use these speakers regularly to play all sorts of audio. Here's the thing, I have not opened the Sonos app since I set these speakers up months or years ago. I play to the speakers using AirPlay or the Apple TV hooked up to the Beams. I was genuinely surprised to hear that anyone cared whether the Sonos app worked or not. It's totally irrelevant to my Sonos use case. What am I missing here? Is there some amazing thing in the Sonos app that makes it a must use? I think, strictly speaking, I believe in order to have lossless playback, you need to use Sonos app, but I could not possibly care less about that. Just to be clear, I don't care. I don't think I'm capable of hearing the difference. I don't think you are either,
You're not.
I don't care. So in any case, the reason I like it, I feel like I might have glanced off of this last episode, but the reason I like doing using the Sonos app is because I don't want to do any sort of, or I don't want my phone or other device to be in the midst of playing anything when I'm trying to use it. I view the ambient music in the house to be a house thing, not a Casey's phone thing. There's nothing wrong with what Ryan is saying. And if that works for you, then keep on keeping on. I mean, that's great. But to me, I like having everything in the Sonos app, the playback, the management of speakers, the management of volume, I like having it all in there. And for all of the foibles that the Sonos app has, and it does have many, managing which things you're playing and the volume of each is so much better, even in the crummy versions of that app, than it is for me anyway in AirPlay 2. I find when I start an AirPlay 2 speaker, it's oh, yes. Okay, yes. I'll play music now at a volume that is nowhere near the volume you expect. It will either be exceedingly loud or almost silent. And that is just not what I want. And so for me, I don't care for using AirPlay 2. And the only time I do, coincidentally, is with this podcast app I like called Overcast. That's pretty much the only time I ever use AirPlay 2 for any of my Sonos stuff. So that's my use case. I don't know, Marco, you might have the opposite opinion of me, because I thought you were mostly AirPlaying. Is that right?
Yeah. I almost never open the Sonos app for any reason. The only reasons I open it are like to change configuration, basically. Like if I want to, like, you know, either if I'm adding or removing a product, or if I the other day I moved some stuff around to different rooms, or did, you know, to modify some stuff there, or if I want to like change some settings, like, oh, I want to change the EQ on this speaker. Like, otherwise I am never in that app. Like, there is never a time when I think I would like to play music, let me dive into that mess and connect it to all my stuff. Like, no, that never happens. I use Sonos for TV sound and for AirPlay sound, and I never open the app for anything else.
Yeah, that's fair. And I'm not trying to say that I'm right or and you're wrong. It's just not the way I think of and want to manage my music. This is actually very similar to the opinions that I had about Spotify versus Apple Music. Bear with me here. One of the things I loved about Spotify before their app got real bad, but Up until a couple of years ago when I really went all in on Apple Music, the Spotify app, I viewed that as ephemeral music. Like, yes, I marked favorites and so on and so forth, but that was music that I didn't own and that could go away at any moment. And that was where their music lived. Even the music I liked, it was their music. It's over there. And I liked having iTunes, you know, Apple Music would have like the non-streaming form of Apple Music, the Apple Music app. I liked that as being my music, the stuff I brought, you know, maybe it's Dave Matthews concerts or maybe it's stuff I paid for, whatever the case may be. And one of the things that really turned me off about Apple Music originally when I first started converting to it was that there was no delineation between my music and their music. Over time, I've started to feel differently about that. And I don't think it really matters because my music is kind of everything, right? Like there really is, the distinction was always kind of synthetic or arbitrary anyway, but it's that sort of delineation. I like compartmentalizing the home music playback to the home and, you know, my playback, be that, you know, Instagram, or maybe I'm watching something while the, you know, there's ambient music playing, that can happen on my phone. All right. With regard to DeepSeek censoring in different models, Sebastian Roschka writes, while the 671B DeepSeek R1 flagship models based on 671B DeepSeek V3, the smaller DeepSeek R1 models have different base models. That's a lot of models in one sentence. That's okay. A possible explanation is that the difference in censoring could already be taking place on the base model level. The 70 billion models based on Llama, which is Meta AI's model, then the 32 billion model is based on Qwen or Xuan, Qwen. I'm sorry, I butchered that. A model by another Chinese company. You can confirm this via the official technical report, page 14, table 5, which is in GitHub, and we will link in the show notes.
That makes a lot more sense to me. That like I didn't realize the 70 billion one was based on Llama, so that one probably doesn't have Llama as Meta's Meta / Facebook's AI model. That one doesn't have Chinese government censoring in it versus the 32 billion model based on another Chinese model. So. Yeah, that's a lot of this is, I think, branding is the confusing thing. Like, oh, these are all DeepSeek LLMs, but it's like, well, what is the base model? And is the base model for the big one you're using through the app the same as the base model for the small ones you can download? And apparently it's not. So that does make more sense, but it is still kind of weird that this one company is fielding these different models with different base models with very different censorship behaviors. But that's apparently the way it is now.
Right. Screen time, we talked about, I think, was it John? You had like some sort of throwaway comment about that. What was the genesis?
Yeah, it's just it's another one of those things that is complained about all the time by me and others. And so last episode, I made my, I don't know, annual, biannual screen time unreliability complaint because it's unreliable.
Right. So Jonathan writes, I don't see anything wrong with screen time numbers. And they provided an image where it says screen time, all devices, daily average, 2,395 hours and 49 minutes.
That's a high daily average.
That is indeed. That takes a lot
of
work.
Even if you have, like, if you buy every product that Apple owns and you leave them open and running all the time, setting aside the fact that it shouldn't be counting that as your screen time if you're not in front of that computer, I still don't think you can hit 2,300 hours a day. That would be a lot of open devices with a lot of open apps all counting at the same time. This was not the only feedback we got about screen time. And my offhanded aside about how screen time has never been reliable, so many people sent screenshots of their completely absurd, ridiculous numbers that don't make any sense, even when the numbers were within the realm of imaginable reason of like, well, 30-something hours, and maybe it's counting multiple apps that I'm running on my Mac at the same time, blah, blah, blah. The numbers never made sense to the people reporting them. It's like, this doesn't feel like, I can't connect these numbers to things that I did. And so what's the point of this feature? Like I said, it might as well be a random number generator that just makes a bunch of graphs. This has never worked. I tried to use it for my kids to track and control. The control part, by the way, also doesn't work very well. But the tracking definitely doesn't work. Because they're like, what apps are my little kids using and how long are they spending on? Who knows? Because the little numbers and bar graphs are basically meaningless. They've had this feature in their operating system for years. They advertise it. And as far as I can tell, it just does not work and has never worked.
Cool. All right. Last episode, you had made mention of Apple's Unix certification of Mac OS. And Paulo Pinto writes, it is still certified as Unix 03, but there are several things that have to be enabled or changed so that Mac OS actually works as a certified Unix. Also, the latest standard is version Unix 07. There was recently a very ranty article on OS News going over how Apple has achieved its certification. We'll link that from Tom Howelda, I believe. Anyways, Tom writes, in order to be allowed to use the Unix trademark, your operating system needs to comply with the single Unix specification, SUS, which specifies programming interfaces for C, a command line shell, and other end user commands, more or less identical to POSIX, as well as the X or open curses specification. macOS 15.0 only conforms to version 3 of the SUS, which is what Paula was saying, which dates all the way back to the ancient times of 2004, when Marco and I were just graduating college. And as such, macOS is only Unix 03 on both Intel and ARM. However, you can argue that this is just semantics, since it's not like Unix and POSIX are very inclined to change.
Yeah, I'm kind of surprised Apple was keeping this up, because if you read the article, which is provocatively titled Apple's macOS Unix Certification is a Lie, they like basically there are a bunch of settings in macOS that you have to toggle to make it so that macOS passes whatever the certification is. And I'm kind of amazed that Apple is still doing that, because the settings are probably annoying to maintain, to like, we got to make sure we, you know, they went through the effort to certify what was then macOS 10 as a real trademark Unix, all caps UNIX, and they've just kept up that certification by every time they add something to macOS that would make it not comply, they have a switch that says put it back to the compliant mode. And most of the things that like that they've switched or whatever, it's better the way macOS does it out of the box. But to pass the test, it has to do it the slightly worse old way. And so they have a way to do it. They have a way, okay, turn it back on, turn this thing off, turn this performance enhancement off, change this behavior back to the way this Unix specification wants it. Now, they're not keeping up with the certifications. It's not like they're, you know, I don't know how much, what difference is between Unix 03 to Unix 07, but I'm actually very surprised that Apple has kept this up, and I think they're putting in a surprising amount of effort there, and I don't mind that these things have to be settings. I would be just fine if they left it behind and said, you know what, we're not going to bother complying with that. All those settings, remove them, remove that code, remove those conditionals, because in most cases, when you look at what they are, they're things that are not relevant to the average person's life, or they're things that no end user would ever, like, if they had some software that wasn't working right because that setting was wrong, like a lot of them require like disabling system integrity protection and stuff like that. It's like, no, thanks. I'd like to leave exactly. System integrity protection enabled. And I would like modern behaviors. I don't really care about compliance with a 2004 Unix spec. But there you have it. Apparently, they're still complying. I don't know if it's just corporate inertia, but Apple, I think you can safely leave that one behind. You don't need to keep maintaining all those feature toggles.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think Tom was particularly worked up about the fact that, yes, you have to flip these switches. But I agree with you. Like, this is the march of progress. And things are better the way it ships by default, I guess, unless you're a purist. But for any regular or reasonable human, it's better this way. And at least a fallback is provided. Now, I concur as well with you, John, that I think it's probably long since time that they just walk away from all this. But I don't really understand why we are all
like a government contracts. You can only use this software if it's Unix compliant in some government application. But honestly, if that was the case, that there would be people in government taking macOS and making it like worse and less secure to pass government compliance stuff, which again is not too surprising. But yeah, nope. There's always reasons for this type of stuff. But it would be nice if they moved on from this. But apparently, they're still doing it. So there you have it.
We had talked a couple of weeks ago, was it Overtime, I believe, that we were talking about this? Is that right?
Yeah, I think so. The Switch 2 intro.
Right. We were talking about the Switch 2 introduction, and I believe, if memory serves, Marco was convinced that the Joy-Cons would not support any sort of mouse movement, and John was convinced that they absolutely would. And it turns out that John is owed a dollar from Marco because...
We don't know that yet, but well, it's leaning in my direction.
It's certainly all signs point to yes. So reading from Ars Technica, the Japanese language patent about the Switch 2 Joy-Cons, whose illustrations match what we've seen of Switch 2 Joy-Cons precisely, features an English abstract describing, quote, a sensor for mouse operation, quote, that can detect reflected light from a detected surface, the light changing by moving over the detected surface, much like any number of optical computer mice. Schematic drawings in the patent show how the light source and light sensor are squeezed inside the Joy-Con, with a built-in lens for directing the light to and from each. A machine translation of the full text of the patent describes the controller as a novel input device that can be used as a mouse and other than a mouse.
I love patent language.
Mm-hmm. That could also be the translation, but yes. In mouse mode, as described in the patent, the user cradles the outer edge of the controller with their palm and places the inner edge on, for example, a desk or the like.
Side mousing.
Yep. I think it's a thing. I mean, we'll see. You're right. It's not a done deal, but it certainly seems like a thing. We had talked about at some point how it's difficult to hear dialogue on TV shows these days because the three of us are old. And Nicholas Carenti writes, on the topic of poor dialogue mixing in streaming shows and movies, I've been using the solution for years now and it works great. Use AirPods with your Apple TV. The sound quality is excellent and I can understand dialogue clearly every time. What makes it even better is that Apple TV lets multiple people connect their AirPods simultaneously. My partner and I have made this our default way to watch TV. We only switch back to regular speakers when we have multiple guests over. It's become such a game changer that I consider Apple TV's best feature. Have any of you ever tried the setup either solo or with someone else? I do this probably once or twice a week when it's just me. A great example of this is from my kitchen, you can see into the living room, and since /R/TV too high, you can see the TV from the kitchen. But in order to hear it, I either need to grab one of my Sonos portable speakers, which occasionally I'll do, or I'll just throw in my AirPods, and then I can hear it much better without having to crank, you know, the main sound system. But I can't say that I've ever done this with Aaron, and it sounds like it would be awfully burdensome to start and stop every time. But again, I've never tried it, so I might have that, you know, totally wrong.
Yeah, this is kind of a testament to how difficult it is to get good audio in home television watching environments. Because, I mean, I think most people just use their TV speakers, and TV speakers are usually terrible. And that means that whatever sound was recorded in the show, setting aside how well the dialogue is mixed and whatever, it has to pass through your cruddy TV speakers and bounce off the back of the plastic casing and the wall and the floor and everything and eventually get to your ears. And by the time it gets there, it's substantially changed from what was originally put into the show. Again, setting aside whether what was put into the show was good or not. What the AirPods are doing for you there is they're cutting out all that in-between stuff. We'll get the audio digitally chew very close to your ear, and then we will amplify it and play it into your ear holes. And so all that stuff that I talked about, the shape of your room, your walls, your cruddy TV speakers, that is all eliminated from things that can make the dialogue hard to hear, and you're left only with how well was dialogue mixed. If everybody had a like theater quality, you know, speaker setup for their television, this wouldn't be as big an issue. When you were sitting on your couch, you'd still only have the problem of how was the audio mixed on the show, and you wouldn't have those other problems. But most people just don't do that. Even if people have something like a soundbar or whatever, it's not like that is even calibrated in any way or may actually be making things worse when it comes to dialogue legibility than the television speakers, which are often tuned to make dialogue understandable at the cost of other things. Most people don't have fancy hi-fi setups, and it actually is surprisingly difficult to get a home theater setup to do a good job on audio, because most of the audio comes out of the center channel speaker, and for a variety of reasons, the center channel speaker in home theater setup is like the unloved stepchild. It is not the glory speaker. It is not the one that people think about, and yet it is the most important speaker when you're hearing people talk on a television show. And so many things about the design, the physical design of center channel speakers, I think I talked to this on a show a while ago when I was talking about it, my home theater setup, conspire to make the center channel very bad at what it does. Headphones are a great solution to that. If the pairing works well, and if you have a small number of people, that's great. And also, if you don't want to disturb people elsewhere in the house.
Yep. And also, to get ahead of follow-up, you had said, you know, uncalibrated soundbars, that I get the point of what you're saying, but, you know, I can do, I forget what it's called, like it's not True Tone, but it's something where I take my phone and wave it around the room while the Sonos is playing some sort of particular tone, and it will do maybe not the kind of calibration you're talking about, John, but some modicum of calibration.
Yeah, no, I think people just don't even do that. Like, cause it's that's too fair. Burdensome. Mm-hmm. Like, they don't look it up. But most soundbars do have something that you can do to help. Now, does that process help, and how good is it compared to the fancy ones? But still, I bet most people who have a soundbar take it out of the box, hook it up, sound comes out, sit down, that's all. Like, they're not seeking, only like home theater nerds or like actual professional installers are going to even bother launching that app and trying to do it.
Definitely. All right, I have a little bit of news with regard to my status board project. Apparently, a listener of ATP reached out to James from Home is Where the Smart Is, which is a mostly a UK. It's a business in the UK, as well as a like video and YouTube channel and website and whatnot. And James was kind enough to reach out to me after doing so. But let me read what Home is Where the Smart Is all about. This is what James had written. The trouble was most guides I found to doing LED stuff seemed too involved, even for me, usually with soldering and jumper wires all over the place. So my dad and I set about making the easiest starter boards we could, as he is the brains behind the circuit board designs. So we've designed these very small boards, which can be powered from USB if you wish, or mainly for strips that are different voltages, like 12 volts and 24 volts. You can leave the USB alone and power the strip instead with an external power supply, and the board will power from the strip. So James was kind enough to reach out and send me all the way from across the pond, send me a couple of the Homes Where the Smart Is boards. And what these are hilariously, ridiculously, absurdly tiny ESP32 boards with a little bit of electronics around them. It's ridiculous how small these things are. I cannot overstate how impressively tiny they are. It's basically the ESP32 and the teeniest little bit of electronics around. I know I just said that, but like, I cannot stress enough. I'd never seen an ESP32 before, and they're so freaking small. They're like the size, they're less than the size of an American postage stamp. So anyways, James has sent me one of these and sent me a small strip of, you know, nanopixels. Or what is, I forget the name of it, but it's like the, whatever I was talking about a couple of weeks ago, the 8212 or something like that. I'll put a link in the show notes. Forgive me. I forget exactly what these are. But what this allows me to do is, you know, James had pre-assembled all of this for me. And what it is it's this ESP32, which he has preloaded with WLED, which is a Home Assistant style, like open source project with the best URL I've ever seen in my life. The URL for WLED project is kno.wled.ge, which spells out knowledge. Wow. So good. So good. Anyway, so it's this WLED software. And what I did was I plugged in the strip to a USB port. I connected to the Wi-Fi that this little itty bitty postage stamp size chip is broadcasting. I set it to, I gave it my actual Wi-Fi credentials. And the next thing you know, I have a web interface for controlling the strip of like 10 LEDs, which is cool. And I guess there's a open source iPhone app that you can download from the store or whatever, and you can control them that way as well, which is also cool. But the key, though, is that as soon as I went back to Home Assistant, have I told you guys I'm into Home Assistant these days? Maybe we should talk about it. I went back to Home Assistant and I opened it up and it said, hey, I just detected a new WLED device. And so I think you might want to use it. And I said, yes, yes, I do. And within not too terribly long, I now have my status board insofar as a strip of little LED lights that are addressable, and the hue or the color is configurable, and the brightness. And so I have a red LED for when the garage door is open, a white LED that changes the brightness based on the inverse of how charged the car is. When the car is almost charged, it's very, very dim, and it goes off when it's charged. When it's not very charged at all, it's as bright as the sun, or at least that's what it seems like sometimes. And then finally, a blue LED for when the mail is waiting for us. Now, you might ask, where have I mounted this? And right now it's just sitting freeballing on my desk because I haven't figured out where to put it. But this is such cool tech. And the Historical Commission is not aware of much of this happening at this time because I haven't figured out where to mount it. I think, to be honest with you, I might just mount it on like the incredible forehead of one of my LG 5Ks, just so it's in the office. Because as Marco was chuckling and remembers, the forehead in the LG 5K is quite, it's only like an inch, but it seems just obscenely large when you look at it. And so I might just mount it there and then, you know, plug the USB power into the back of the studio, or excuse me, the LG 5K. I just got to say, this tech is so cool. And getting these components individually, again, James was kind enough to send these for free and didn't ask for a plug or anything, but I'm genuinely plugging because I enjoyed it. But you can get these boards, and I think Americans, you'd have to dispatch them from Amazon UK, which is probably a little bit pricey. But nevertheless, you can get these itty bitty teeny tiny boards, and you can get these pretty affordable LED strips, and you can do whatever you want. And this WLED software is super cool. You can power it through MQTT, or not power it, but you can configure it through MQTT. You can configure it through Home Assistant. I'm sure there's like a REST API or something if you want to go that route. All extremely cool stuff. And as if that wasn't good enough, our friends at Terminal delivered my terminal, and I believe John's as well. And so I set mine up, and I'll let John talk and speak to whether or not he did anything with his yet. this thing is really freaking cool. Now, they are a future sponsor, and they did send me a freebie. So I'm telling you my genuine, honest opinion. But to be fair, they did send me a free one, and they will be sponsoring in the future. But it is very cool. And the only thing that kind of bummed me out a little bit about it was I didn't realize that for purposes of keeping the battery to last more than 5 minutes, it only refreshes at most every 15 minutes. And so at first, before mine showed up, I'd like coded up this whole WebSockets-based thing that showed the status board in the corner of the terminal. And I was all excited for it. Oh, and God. Then I plugged it all in and I opened the garage door and nothing happened. And it took me a while to realize, oh, nothing happened because it only updates every like 15 minutes. And it does that for a perfectly good reason. Let me try that again. Hello, Marco. Sorry, Hi. That burp came from nowhere. It does that for perfectly good reason. It's because if you refresh even every 15 minutes, it's dramatically less battery life than it would be otherwise. And once I took that status board off and told it, no, anything else you're showing, you can refresh once an hour, maybe even more than that. Battery life has been phenomenal. And so since I optioned the bigger battery, I got to imagine this is going to last at least a couple of months, maybe even as I think they quoted 6 months, but we'll see what happens. But I really like this terminal thing, and it's very affordable. So even if I had paid for it, I think I would be saying all the same stuff. It is very slick and very cool. And the fact that you can cause update, or I shouldn't say cause updates, the fact that you can give their servers updates, which eventually the terminal will go and request via WebSockets, is super cool. Not WebSockets. I keep saying WebSockets. What am I thinking of?
Like web requests?
No. Not website. The WebSockets is the thing that, the thing where you trigger stuff. Like GitHub uses these all the time. I'm drawing a total blank.
Webhooks.
Webhook. Thank you, John. Gosh, you saved my life there. Anytime I've said WebSocket in the last few minutes, I meant webhook. I apologize. That's 100%
AKA an HTTP request.
AKA an HTTP request. You're exactly right. But anyways, very cool stuff. I really enjoy the stuff that James had sent. Again, home is where the smart is. We'll put a link in the show notes. I really enjoyed this terminal thing. And even if you're not interested in either of those devices, ultimately, they're both powered by the same stuff, which is the ESP32, which is that little teeny tiny chip. Very good. John, have you any updates on your terminal?
I got mine and I set it up. I tried a bunch of different display settings once the terminal website fixed its broken CSS, because their CSS was 404ing over the weekend. Somebody pushed a bad update there. But anyway, they fixed it. What I landed on was weather and calendar, but not the month calendar, because I found that the month calendar, with the amount of stuff our family has on our shared calendar with all our stuff in it, is just too much information for that small of a display, especially if you want anything else to be there. So I kind of wish they sold one that was four times as big.
Yeah, I hear that. I do.
Right? Because then I would have more room for them. So what I have is I have the calendar showing just the day's activity. Well, it shows like the next couple of days, but it's not the whole big grid of the calendar month or whatever, and then the weather. And I was trying to find out where I'm going to put this in the house. I ended up putting it basically like over the thermostat in the dining room. It's in a place central in the house. You walk by it a lot. When we get ready in the morning, people are eating breakfast at that table, they can glance up and see what the weather is and what's on the schedule for the day. But usually the question is, for me, they're asking me, do you have a podcast tonight? And I say, it's on the calendar. It's not a question. Like, they'll be shocked that I have a podcast on tonight. It's like, for something that's been on the calendar for like months at a time, or in the case of ATP, it's just always like, what? Anyway, it's on the calendar, but they don't see the calendar, or they, you know. So anyway, now there's slightly less of an excuse, because they're literally walking by the thing every day that says what my podcast schedule is. And also, you know, it's got everyone else's schedule on there as well. So I am enjoying it. I'm also curious to see how long the battery will last. I also got the bigger battery. I just stuck it on the wall. It was fully charged when I put it there, and we'll see how long it lasts.
Yeah, hey, I have mine set to only refresh, I think, every 30 minutes or hour.
I think mine's close to that too.
And I have yet to have to charge it. Like, I stuck it on the wall with Velcro strips, and it's still there. Like, and that was, I think, a month and a half ago or 2 months.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, a couple of quick notes on that. First of all, my setup is during the morning when it's like the high transit getting out the door sort of situation. I have the left-hand side show the next, you know, day's calendar. The right-hand side is then split in half again, so it's the weather at the top and a countdown until spring break for the kids on the bottom. And then once everyone is kind of migrated out of the house, the kind of, you know, steady state of it is the monthly calendar, which for me, I totally understand what you're saying, John, but for us, that's still simple enough that we can get away with it. And then the other thing I was going to say is I believe, and I check my math on this, but I think that a lot of Terminal's backend stuff is or will be open sourced. So hypothetically, John, you could get your own e-ink display, you know, of a different size and use a lot of their software or maybe fork their software to power it. Now, I know that you probably don't have any interest in that, nor do I, but that is something that I think they would enable you to do if you wanted to go down that route. Again, check my math on that. I might be lying to you by accident.
Yeah, probably, although I would imagine an e-ink screen of the size that I want actually would be kind of expensive, because if you think about the biggest e-ink devices like the Remarkable tablets or whatever, they do start to get costly when screens get big. So I'm not even sure how big they may make e-ink screens these days.
Yep. All right, John, any hyperspace updates for us?
Yep. The test flight is ongoing. We passed an important milestone this past week, which is that the test flight version will now reclaim one file for real.
Whoa, look at that.
Whoa. In your updates. I was trying to figure out what would be the first step between, like, you know, not actually making any changes, but, you know, it was do all the work right up into it, but then it would just throw away the work that it did because I didn't want to mess with people's disks until I had some confidence. I figured one file was the best choice because at the end of reclaiming, it can point you to, you know, there's a big button to reveal it in the Finder. Here's the one file. Look at the one file. Because if I did like more than one, I was like, oh, I don't want to have to manually check those files, but you can manually check one file. And what I want you to do, all the testers, I want them to reclaim one file for real and look at that file and make sure it's not destroyed. I disabled the setting that like skips the trash can or whatever. If it is destroyed, pull out the original from the trash. Right? But so far, no one has reported any kind of damage or problem with the restoration process. I think people are reclaiming. People have said they successfully reclaimed. They say, oh, it looks fine to me. It looks fine. Works fine. I tried it. You know, like, so good. Thumbs up. I'm going to be in the one file mode for a little while, partially because we're going on a family trip soon. And during that time, I don't want to be messing with too much test flight stuff. So there'll be a little bit of a pause here. While I paused, everybody who is a beta tester, please keep reclaiming one file. If you have a thing that says, oh, I found, 10,000 files, you can reclaim all of them. You just got to do 10,000 separate runs. And it'll do one file for real each time. As I said in the testing notes, if you want to pick which file that is, just deselect everything except for a single file group. And then within that file group, only select one file. And then you can guarantee which one file it will do. Otherwise, I think it picks the biggest file. But yeah, the bug, I've burned down all of the outstanding bug reports as far as I'm aware. There's some enhancement requests and some stuff like that. But I'm getting close to being ready to ship this. Like I said, my trip will probably put a little delay in this, but probably early next month I'm probably going to be shipping even before then, because I've more or less drawn a line in the sand that I'm not going to add more features at this point, although I did sneak one in a couple days ago. But I'm really getting to the point where I just want to say what's there is what's there, make sure it works, and then I got to do all the other stuff of, you know, try to find some way to make screenshots for this. I always did such a bad job on the screenshots. It's not a very exciting app. Make a web page, an announcement thing, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, it's getting close. The testers have been great. I did start a Slack for it, by the way. I mentioned that in the test flight notes. Slack is being so weird. Like, I made a Slack for it. I have a Slack for Switch class as well. But, like, the invite link that I put in there, for some people, it has never worked, and yet other people have been joining successfully with that link as recently as today. Some people say, oh, this link has expired. I tried it myself, and it worked for me when I did it in an incognito window, but other people say, yeah, that link never worked. So anyway, if you want to join the Slack, as I say in the notes, you can just email the address that's listed there and just say, hey, I want to join the Slack, and the link didn't work for me. I don't know why the link doesn't work for you. I can't figure out what's wrong with Slack these days, but it's an issue. But anyway, yeah, people have been filing great reports. Some people have joined the Slack because they prefer to give feedback that way. Some people are emailing me. Some people are using test flight feedback. It's all systems are go. Oh, and I will release a version of the app that reclaims everything for real after I have a little bit more confidence with the one file thing. But so far, so good.
You know, as a quick aside with regard to Slack, I was using Slack on my iPad, which I do somewhat regularly. And for the 8 millionth time, I hit the up arrow in order to, I think I was in the midst of editing a multi-line thing, and I hit the up arrow to go up within the context of the thing I had written. And of course, what does it do? But it goes to the most recent message that I had posted rather than where it should go, which is up within the editing space that I'm working within. And I fired off like a, you know, help message in Slack for iPad, and I threw it across the wall, assuming it went into dev null. And within like 2 hours or something like that, I got a response from a human saying, huh, this doesn't seem right. We'll look at it.
Slack actually responds to bug reports.
Imagine a world where bug reports are actually responded to. And maybe it wasn't 2 hours, but given that what I'm comparing it to is Apple, which is literally never, it was effectively instant. It was unbelievable. I was so impressed.
Yeah, I've got a lot of good. I've filed a lot of those. I actually probably should have filed the thing on links that I don't understand. Like, why does this link work for some people and other people it doesn't? What am I doing wrong? It's honestly not that important. Again, if people want access to Slack, they could just email me. But the other times that I have filed things, it's totally like you will get a response from someone who seemingly read and understood what you wrote, which is just mind-boggling compared to the Apple experience, where if you do get a response, it's so hard to tell. Did the person who's responding to this even read what I wrote? Or if they did read it, how did they fail to comprehend it? Like, you start questioning everything about what you're writing. Like, was my writing unclear? Like, it's really a terrible experience.
It really is. All right, let's talk about some other terrible things, which is to say Apple has apparently been ordered to open encrypted user accounts globally to UK spying. That's fun. Not US. We're doing everything wrong in the world except this one thing.
Not yet. Don't worry, we'll get time.
Yeah. I feel like I really want to rant about this, and I know in the middle of the show is not the place to do it, and I'm trying to not make a lot more work for Marco, but maybe in an after show I can pop off about what this ridiculous coup that's happening right now. Anyways, reading from The Verge, Apple has reportedly been ordered by the UK government to create a backdoor that would give security officials access to users' encrypted iCloud backups. If implemented, British security services would have access to the backups of any user worldwide, not just Brits, and Apple would not be permitted to alert users that their encryption was compromised. I'm sorry, let me read that again. If implemented, British security services would have access to the backups of any user worldwide, not just Brits, and Apple would not be permitted to alert users that their encryption was compromised. The Washington Post reports that the secret order issued last month is based on rights given under the UK's Investigatory Powers Act of 2016, also known as, and I love this, the Snoopers Charter. Officials have apparently demanded blanket access to end-to-end encrypted files uploaded by any user worldwide rather than access a specific account. Apple's iCloud backups aren't encrypted by default, but the advanced data protection option was added in 2022 and must be enabled manually. It uses end-to-end encryption so that not even Apple can access encrypted files. In response to the order, Apple is expected to simply stop offering advanced data protection in the UK. This wouldn't meet the UK's demand for access to files shared by global users, however. Apple has the right to appeal the notice on the basis of cost of implementing it and whether the demand is proportionate to the security requirements, but any appeal cannot delay implementation of the original order. This is such a bonkers set of rules. My goodness. The UK has reportedly served Apple a document called a technical capability notice. It is a criminal offense to even reveal that the government has made a demand. Similarly, if Apple did accede to the UK's demands, then it apparently would not be allowed to warn users that its encrypted service is no longer fully secure. Now, in case you think the Washington Post is crazy, let's talk about the BBC, who writes, this misguided attempt at tackling crime and terrorism will not make the UK safer, but it will erode the fundamental rights and civil liberties of the entire population, privacy campaigners Big Brother Watch said in a statement. Another quote, the main issue that comes from such powers being exercised is that it's unlikely to result in the outcome they want, said Lisa Forte, cybersecurity expert from Redgoat. Criminals and terrorists will just pivot to other platforms and techniques to avoid incrimination. So it's the average law-abiding citizen who suffers by losing their privacy. Entire country that loves security cameras more than anyone in the entire world decides that they get to security cam anything they want in our iCloud backups. Color me surprised.
Well, they're not deciding this, but here, this is a situation where we've talked about Apple dealing with like difficult government demands and just navigating various laws in different countries, but this one I feel like is just so incredibly clarifying given how incredibly dumb this law is, which you outlined well, that like that it doesn't just apply to the UK, but they want access to everybody worldwide. So even disabling advanced data protection in the UK does not satisfy it. The answer is Apple pulls out of the UK. No more Apple products will be sold in the UK. That is the only answer to this, because anything else is inconceivable unless the Verge article is wrong about what it requires to comply. Because if it was just a matter of, okay, people in the UK can't get advanced data protection, oh, well, sucks for them. But if that doesn't do it, and the only solution is they want a backdoor to everything worldwide, no more Apple products in the UK. Like, that is the direct, very straightforward, only possible consequence of this thing going through. Now, maybe their appeal, something will happen there. Like, it's so difficult to predict what will happen. But given this description of the law, that is the only thing that can happen, right? Like, what am I missing? Well, is there any possible other thing that could possibly happen?
I mean, I think the most likely outcome here is that most countries, like most, especially kind of like, you know, similar countries in like, you know, development and law enforcement status as the US and Europe and everything, I think most countries are going to make advanced data protection illegal. And Apple's going to have to disable it or not offer it in those regions. And I think the US is right behind them. Like, there's no way because the culture of law enforcement is that they feel genuinely entitled to everything from everyone all the time. They do not like having, you know, roadblocks put in their face, like the Constitution or rights or due process. And the last thing they want is a technical roadblock, which they cannot get around. So law enforcement worldwide would love to just have access to whatever they demand. And the more they can just have it on everybody and get these pesky judges and processes and constitutions out of the way, the better. And look, they're not like evil people. They think they're doing it for good reasons. They think they're protecting us from terrorists and stuff. Like, those are like, and in their world, they are justified in their thinking here. Unfortunately, that conflicts with, you know, rights and constitutions
and reality, because
and security.
I mean, like they think even within their world, if their world was just expansive enough to realize what the reality of their world is that when you make a backdoor like this, the bad people get access to it, and you get compromised in a worse way than you can possibly. It happened recently with China finding a way into one of the backdoors that was mandated into some telecom system in the US, right?
Yeah.
There is no way to make a backdoor just for the good guys. So by demanding that a backdoor exists, you are essentially self-owning. You are compromising your system because the bad people will get access to it. And if you're a law enforcement agency, that doesn't help you. It's not actually justified, even within their world of like, well, if we just look at what our needs as a law enforcement agency are, this is the right thing to do. It's not even right then. It is just wrongheaded in every possible way. But I agree that they think it's the right thing to do. They're just absolutely wrong.
Right. But the reality of what's going to happen here, we have our own problems here in the U.S., obviously, with our recent politics. But like a swing to the right and authoritarianism is not limited just to the U.S. recently. This has been happening in a lot of the developed world. And so I think the culture of law enforcement and government, you know, having full control over people and the erosion of freedoms is happening in a lot of places, especially in technology. And the tech companies are never – like, there is not a chance in hell Apple pulls out of a market. No. Apple will keep making all their money in every single market they possibly can. And what they will do is just the same thing they've done with so many other things. China, the Gulf of America.
They're
going to say we have to follow the laws in the countries in which we operate.
But they're
going to just not offer the encryption in these countries. Like, that's what's going to happen.
That won't solve it. Like, according to what is written here, they can't do that. That's what I was going to say before. Like, in China, they're able to bend over backwards and do what the Chinese government wants. The Chinese government does not want as much as the UK government does. The Chinese government asked for something that they could actually get, which is within China, we have all these rules, we get access to all your servers, blah, 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 blah. But the UK is asking for more than that. They're saying, you have to compromise everybody in the entire world to satisfy our law. Even China didn't ask for that.
Well,
like,
okay.
if Apple
in all
could,
fairness, like I think that detail is very likely to say never mind. Like I think that one particular detail, like
when does that never mind happen? Does that never mind happen in the appeal process? Because I don't think the law can be changed in the appeal process. Anyway, I mean, we're just going by this article here, but by what is written in the article, Apple can't do what it has historically done. Its only choices are backdoor every single Apple customer worldwide in perpetuity without telling anybody, or pull out of the UK. And that's why I think they won't do what they did in the UK, in China. If they could do that, you're right, they would. If they can just say, okay, well, there's a simple change we can make. It's different for the people in China. Now it's different for the people in the UK. That's their deal. That's their problem. Their justification for China is like, well, it's better than us not being there because as compromised as we are, we're still the least compromised in all of China, which I think is true, but it's a low bar. And they could say the same thing in the UK. But it seems like, again, I'm not a lawyer and I have not read this law. I'm just going by the articles in The Verge. It seems like they can't do that, which is why the only option is pull out of the UK.
Or the option also, again, not a lawyer, but the other option could be they will comply within the UK and they just won't comply with people outside the UK, and the UK can sue them and they'll see what happens and they'll challenge it.
Yeah, I suppose. Like, it's you're learning lots of lessons from the current administration of just like, what if I just ignore the law? Then what happens? Tends not to be Apple's MO anywhere. They're much more likely to fall. Like, I would imagine what would happen is that this law is so wrongheaded and Apple is so large and powerful and the threat of pulling out is so so powerful to elected people in the UK, because if Apple did pull out and everybody in the UK knew it was because of this dumb law, a lot of people aren't getting reelected. So I imagine what will actually happen is big important people will have big important discussions and this will be changed. And they'll at the very least, they'll change it so that all of the badness is confined to the UK, which sucks if you're in the UK. But that is absolutely what Apple will do in that case. They'll be like, fine, if we don't have to do it worldwide, we'll just do it in the UK. Everybody will know that it's happening in the UK because we leaked this or whoever leaked this. Like, it's not, Apple can't technically say anything about it, but now we all know about it. So when advanced data protection disappears in the UK, we'll be like, oh, that's why. But the problem is with this law, if advanced data protection disappears in the UK, but doesn't disappear anywhere else, how do we know that Apple hasn't compromised all of its customers everywhere? We would assume they wouldn't, because that just doesn't seem like something Apple would do. But the law says that they can't say anything either way. So all these laws that that require you not to say anything about something the government is making you do are terrible. I feel like the terribleness of those laws should be confined to the company, to the country that a company is in. Like, the U.S. government can make Apple do that, but I don't feel like it's tenable to have any government in the world be able to do that. So I really hope that if they can't come to agreement, Apple will just come out and say, look, this is what they asked us to do, and we said no.
Yeah. It's just crummy. It's gross. I mean, and I'm, as much as I'm getting fired up about this, I mean, honestly, we have no leg to stand on as Americans right now. It's I'm doing everything in my power.
It is very similar in that it is like, what kind of decision can we make that everybody who has a brain knows is bad and wrong, but can we just force that through because we won an election? And will there be any consequences from that? And we're all in that finding out phase right now, because a bunch of bad people with bad ideas were elected and they're doing stupid stuff. And now it's a question of how far can you go with that? Because there are, at least in the UK, I would imagine, would definitely be electoral consequences of forcing Apple out of your country. Because I think a lot of people in the UK who vote like Apple products. That would not be a good move for you as a politician or as a political party. And yet I feel like that is the inevitable consequence of holding the line on this one, which is probably why they will back off and do something and, you know, change it around or whatever. But boy, like, just dumb people are going to be dumb, man. I mean, like, and the U.S. does exactly the same thing. There's always things going through the legislature in this country of like, we want to have a back door, but only for the good guys. And just like, how many times do we need to have this conversation?
That's like, not how math works.
Like, it's just, you can, because that sells well. You can get people to vote for you, say, I'm going to protect you. I'm going to make sure that the good guys, blah, 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 because it's too, like, it's too nuanced and weird and techie to explain to people why this is terrible. And so we just keep coming back to that same thing around and around and around. Like, every government in every part of the world will just keep coming to the same thing. Because for the reason Marco said, law enforcement wants it. You can run on it and seem like you're going to get elected because you're helping protect the people. And then when the rubber hits the road, hopefully you'll get enough smart people to talk and say, this is impossible. It can't be done. It's not a thing. This is not a thing, right? And sometimes it gets forced through anyway. Like, whatever, I wish I could find a link to that. The U.S. thing where we got owned because we did force through our law that required government to have backdoor access to some telecom system. And, oh, look, China found the backdoor. No one could have guessed that would have happened except everybody who ever looked at it and said, the bad guys will get the backdoor because it's the best thing to get. If there's a backdoor, everybody wants it, and they'll get it. It's maddening. But we are doomed as a species to have this debate over and over again. And the only thing we can hope is that, you know, smarter heads will prevail eventually on this issue, even if we have degrees of backsliding. So fingers crossed that the UK dodges this one, and fingers crossed that enough people notice what happened in the US with the telecom thing getting compromised. And maybe the next time one of these laws comes up, someone in Congress will bring this up. Not that it matters, because Congress doesn't vote based on reason anyway. It's totally a tribal thing. Our country is broken. But anyway, UK, good luck. We need it, and so do you.
Hello, future Marco.
Hi.
A couple of things here. First of all, I really fucking want to rant right now, and I know we can't release it, but can I please?
Feelings podcast for that.
Fine. All right, fine. Secondly, do we want to do the elegant thing? I think we have time.
We should at least do something happy. So we can be the elegant.
No, let's do it. I think it's pretty happy.
All right, yeah, or we can do SKTP.
All right, no. Let's
do it. We can do both.
Yeah, I think we can do both.
All right, let's try it.
All right, goodbye, future Marco. So last week, I think it was, or thereabouts, we got a very surprising release from Apple at machinelearning.apple.com. We got Elegant, E-L-E-G-N-T, Expressive and Functional Movement Design for Non-Anthropomorphic Robots. And this is a short web page. It's not even really a full website. It's really just a web page for the most part. It has a link to the full publication, and it has a very cute 5-minute video. And in that 5-minute video, you see, what is it, Lux that I'm thinking of from Pixar? Is that right?
Luxo Jr., yeah.
Luxo Jr., thank you. It's a lamp very similar to Luxo Jr., and the TLDR of this video is, look, if you're writing the code, or you're effectively like piloting a robot, then the most efficient thing for the robot to do is go from point A to point B. And that is fine, but it's kind of clinical when perceived by a human. And what Apple is saying is, hey, if we take a kind of circuitous way to from point A to point B, and maybe overshoot, or, you know, kind of like brace ourselves to get ready to go and then launch out and go, if we have these sort of human qualities to it, it's a much more enjoyable experience for the humans observing it. And they have this video that demonstrates this. And honestly, the difference between the kind of clinical standard robot and the more emotional, if you will, robot was really stark for me. And I really preferred looking at and imagining interacting with the more emotional robot rather than the one that is arguably more efficient. And they even showed an example where the robot is housing a voice assistant. And, you know, when they asked the robot the question, and it kind of like, if I remember right, it kind of like leaned back and thought about it for a second, and it didn't just immediately answer the question. And they're doing this side by side and split screen with the clinical version, as I keep calling it, although that's not what they called it, and the emotional version, again, not what they called it. And the clinical version was done quicker, but the emotional version was so much more pleasurable to interact with, or at least that's what I got from it. John, I'm sure you saw the video. So am I bananas, or does this ring true to you?
Well, first, I want to talk about the fact that this webpage exists at all.
Fair.
Because if you've been listening to the show for the past several months, we've talked about the rumor of like a table-sitting Apple home device with a screen, and the screen is robotically controlled. And there's that Apple framework that currently works with that Belkin camera pointy thing, where there's an API from a Mac or other devices where you can control a robot servo type thing, or it's not really a robot, but anyway, a mechanical thing that points a camera in a particular direction. There's a whole framework for that. So many rumors about Apple products potentially using that. Again, there's the Belkin third-party one that you could buy right now that actually does use it. And then the home thing with the screen, where the screen points at you and emotes and so on and so forth. And I guess it's a fun tie-in with the iMac G4, the flat-screen iMac with the cool spring-loaded metal arm thing that they had in the commercial, and it was sort of gesticulating and motioning or whatever. Those are all rumors on Mac Rumors and Bloomberg from Gurman stuff or whatever. Usually, Apple doesn't put up web pages showing technologies that for things that have been rumored. Patents, sure, because those have to be public, and Apple patents everything, and just because there's a patent doesn't mean there's going to be a product. But given half a year or more of rumors of a thing that has a screen / camera on an arm that does that points at things and moves in an emotive way, and then having Apple put this up, it's almost like it's so out of character for Apple, because they don't tend to the analogy has often been used in the Apple community is Apple doesn't make concept cars. A concept car is at car shows, or a car manufacturer will come with a car that they're never going to make, that is usually just a model with nothing on the inside of it or whatever, but that points in a future direction. Here's some ideas we're thinking about. Here's some design ideas. Here's some technology ideas. It's a concept car. It's not a product. It never will be a product. But here it shows the direction of our thinking. And if you squint at this, you can see what our future products might have some of these qualities. Apple doesn't do that. They only show something when they have an actual product. So they don't show their research and development. They don't show their Orion glasses that they're working on in the lab that cost $10,000 that they're not going to ever really sell to consumers. Just show, look, we're working on stuff, and we're making some headway. And we're they could do that. The whole time they were developing the Vision Pro, they could have been having little tech demos of the various technologies as they advanced or whatever. But that's not how Apple goes. But here we have seemingly pretty concrete rumors of a thing with the screen where something moves the screen to point at stuff. And then this research thing that says, hey, we've been doing some research on how to make things point at things in an emotive kind of way. So weird. And it almost makes me think, I guess they're not making that product. Because if they were making it, they would never do this. But maybe the machine learning research people, what? I know they let them publish stuff. Because, obviously with all the LLM stuff or whatever, they've published papers about things or whatever. But I feel like publishing papers versus making a video... And it's not particularly slickly produced. If you've watched a SIGGRAPH video or a video made by graduate students or PhD students, not that I'm saying it's a bad video, but it's not Apple polished WWDC video. It looks for all the world like a SIGGRAPH or a PhD student video. And that's what it smells like. And it's just how did this get out of Apple? How? It really does make me think that they've decided not to make that product with the little emotive arm thing. But anyway, sorry for that big long aside, because it's just boggling my mind that this thing exists. But here it is. I'm looking at it right now, and the webpage is still up. So there you have it. for the difference between the sort of, I would think it was the car welding robot. If you've ever seen, everything's cars with us. Ever seen a car assembly line with the giant robotic arms that weld things on cars? Mm-hmm. They just move in straight lines. They're not trying to be emotive. They're going from one welding position to the next as quickly as possible because time is money. They're not trying to impress anybody. But for something that might sit on your desk and, move around and do things, having it look more friendly makes a difference. But here's the thing. Well, two things. One, the thing about mechanical moving things that I'll get to in a second that I've talked about in the past. But the other thing is, having a personality and being, you called it emotional, less clinical, whatever, however you want to describe this, being more Disney Imagineering, because Disney Imagineering is 100% they do this amazingly well. Getting machines to move in a way that connects with people, either by looking like living things or by evoking emotion or whatever. That's the art of animation. That's how all the, inanimate objects and the Beast Castle and Beauty and the Beast can look like things because they're squashing and stretching, but also because, it's the work of an animator. And you can do that with physical, real-world objects as well to have a better connection. But there is a baseline level of actually doing the thing you want it to do that you need to pass before I feel like you get any benefit from being more emotive. In other words, it has to be able to do the thing before you care about, did it do the thing in a way that that makes a connection with me? Because if it fails to do the thing, those emotive qualities either have no effect or make you hate it more. I'm not entirely sure, given Apple's history for things like Siri, that any product they field with this type of technology is going to pass that baseline bar of, but did it do the thing at all that I wanted it to do, before you get to the point where you can consider, and it did it in such an engaging way, you know? Like, and watching this video, that's all I could think of is how angry people would get at this poor thing if it did not do the thing they wanted. Like, so much of Apple's, so many of Apple's, like, home/intelligence products don't do it, and how all the extra work they're putting into being more emotive would not save it from the wrath of the user. I see it in my own kids when they're trying to talk to our HomePod to turn the lights on and off, and it doesn't work. And the things they have to say about Siri are not kind. And then they talk to the Google device, and it always works. So that's what I'm thinking. I think, like, the people doing this research should go work for Disney Imagineering, because the Disney stuff does do the thing people expect it to do, because they just expect to be entertained. But if you ask this thing to, you know, whatever the, you know, this thing was doing stuff that Apple's never going to ship because it's too expensive. But if you ask the Apple thing to, like, look at me or make sure you can get us all on camera or whatever, and it doesn't do it, you don't care how emotive it was in attempting to do your thing. You just care that it didn't do the thing. And so my pessimism about this whole approach is let's work on the baseline functionality and get that nailed down before you worry so much about this. It doesn't mean you shouldn't be researching this. It's not like you can just add this on later. You should be researching it, but I would be much more impressed by a behind the scenes look at somebody making sure that, like, you know, the next home device is responsive and actually does what you ask it to do, which is a bar that they have not crossed with the current ones. And as I alluded to before, the mechanical nature of this with all these servos and motors and moving parts or whatever is so incredibly expensive and so so requiring of a philosophy that Apple does not currently conform to, which is the repairability and maintenance of something with as many moving parts, that I just can't see any product like this being near on the horizon. Because the thing that is difficult about these devices still today is not so much the computer smarts that controls them, but it's the physical reality of anything that works and moves anything like a living thing. That's why those, like, Boston Robotics terrifying dog things cost a hojillion dollars. It is incredibly expensive to do what our little fleshy flesh and bones and blood and muscles do so easily with a mechanical device. And it's even more expensive to make something like that mass market that you can just sell to consumers, have any expectation of the thing not breaking within a year. So I don't think anything like Luxo Jr. is coming our way anytime soon. If we're lucky, we'll get a HomePod with a screen where the screen, like, rotates and tilts, and hopefully that won't break.
And hopefully it'll work instead of being like, sorry, I can't do that right now.
I wish I had recorded the interaction with Siri the other day. I think one of my HomePods is finally, my original HomePod is finally just, like, not working. You can talk to it, and all it will ever tell you is what you just said, Marco. Like, various excuses about why things don't work. It will never actually do anything. I don't understand it. I can't even tell what version of the OS it's running. When I try to use it in the app, it tells me to bring my phone closer. When I bring my phone closer, nothing happens. So that one may be slowly sailing off over the horizon. But yeah, in the meantime, it is just, it's like sunsetting, sundowning, whatever they call it. You can talk to it and it just talks to you in a series of hums and ums and not hearing back from your responses. And sorry, I couldn't do that. And it will keep the conversation going like a telemarketer or whatever, but it will never actually do anything.
Fun. Ay, ay, ay. All right, let's do a little bit of Ask ATP. And let's start with Glenn Lamb, who writes, what kind of app planning or wireframing tool do y'all use when planning an app? Figma, pen and paper? For me, usually pen and paper, if anything at all, or otherwise, I'll just start throwing stuff against, you know, Xcode and start, you know, whipping up a bare bones version of something in SwiftUI. But oftentimes it's pen and paper, if anything. I've never meaningfully used Figma or what's the S? Sketch? Something? I don't know what I'm thinking of.
Those are both software, but Sketch is the one you're thinking of.
Thank you. There you go. I don't really use any of those personally. So, yeah, it's just pen and paper for me. Marco, let's start with you and then finish with John, please.
I don't do anything like this. I just have an idea and I try to just build it. And I prototype and I design basically by building it. So, you know, in the era of Swift UI, this is actually great for my workflow here, such as it is, because I can actually just try a bunch of different things really quickly. Like, and this is like one of the things I've cited. I talked about it under the radar a bit, but one of the things I cited about like why I like Swift UI, despite, you know, its prickliness in certain points, is that it allows me to quickly iterate and try different designs and try radically different layouts and techniques fairly quickly, so that I, you know, it's similar to the type of prototyping that and kind of design iteration that I think other people are able to use these tools for, but that I'm just not like the right kind of designer to ever do that or think that way. For me to tell whether an idea works, I have to build it. And that's like my design process of like how I get good designs at the end of the day is mostly by just building stuff and trying it and seeing like, does this look good? Does this feel good? Does this work well? And you know, if the answer to any of those is no, I was like, well, all right, let me see what else I can do here. And I just try a bunch of stuff till I find something that works well.
John.
Yeah, I think Marco hit on an important thing. Swift UI makes it so much easier as a programmer to rapidly, I'm not even going to say prototype, but like rapidly get something up on the screen to validate ideas. And if you are primarily a developer, chances are good that your skills are more suited to writing code for trying things out than they are to trying things out in an app like Figma. Because apps like Figma or any kind of design app, it's not like you can just magically use them. It's like, well, I'm a programmer. Of course I can use Simple Media app. Graphics editors are incredibly complicated. And if you don't use them day in and day out and don't know how to use them efficiently, it's a massive slowdown to try to use a tool you're not familiar with. It would be the same thing as taking someone who's an expert at using Figma and Photoshop and sitting them in front of Xcode and saying, now prototype this. They could do it, but they'd be way faster in Figma or Photoshop, right? So it's really a lot about where expertise lies, especially when you're an independent developer. You don't have the luxury of like different departments and different people. You've got your current skill set and you can expand your skill set, but under time pressure with limited resources, normally you're going to lean towards, what do I already know how to do? It's why Marco's got tons of stuff written in PHP. It's like, it's more efficient. Like, I could learn a whole new thing or I could just do it in PHP because I know that'll be done quickly. So during my web development career, did I design things using Sketch or Photoshop or any of those other apps? No, because I'm not as good at using them as I am typing HTML. I would just when I wanted to see a UI, I would have an idea in my head and I would write HTML. Like, and it's like, why don't you just write it down on a piece of paper first? Doing it in HTML for me is faster and better than writing it on a piece of paper, because the fidelity of the HTML, it's literally the thing I'm going to be making. Like, it's there. I don't have to, there's no other step, and I can do it faster and better than I can with a pencil, right? That's the weird thing that people don't think about. It's like, well, surely you need someplace to sketch out these ideas and prototype them. It's like, I'm faster just doing it, like doing the code, yeah. Doing the HTML, doing the whatever. It's not like the finished version, but that literally is, for people with that skill set, the fastest, best way to design things. It's only not that way if you're actually better with a pencil and paper, a pen and paper, Photoshop, Figma, or whatever. And again, you can learn new skills in those areas, but to be really fast with those design tools does actually require lots of use and experience. It's not as simple as like, oh, I'll just learn what the tools do and I'll be done. It's just like coding. There's ways to be more efficient in using the tools that people who do it professionally and repeatedly know that I certainly don't. And so, yeah, how do I figure out the UI? How did I figure out the UI for the app that I'm doing? I just did it in Swift UI. And it's way faster than doing it. It's even faster than doing it in an interface builder, which is another example of like, oh, you can just mock it up in interface builder. At this point, it's probably faster just to do it in Swift UI because I'm going to have to do it in Swift UI anyway. Like, that's what it's going to be written in. And so why would I pull out Interface Builder and drag a bunch of little things out and arrange things and say, okay, now I'll go make that in Swift UI. I've just wasted my time. So me and Mark are on the same page here.
Yeah. I mean, it makes perfect sense to me. All right, this one I think is just for John. Mike Hatfield writes, is HFS Plus still relevant in 2025? If you were adding new spinning drives for media or Linux ISOs in 2025, would you format the file system as APFS or HFS Plus? Context, my Plex library is growing, so I'm adding storage capacity. I'm using a QNAP 4 bay configured as just a bunch of disks connected to a Mac Mini via USB.
HFS Plus is still kind of relevant because it is a file system that was designed in the age of spinning disks. So its behavior with respect to locality of disk head movement is so much better than APFS that it is a faster file system on spinning disks. Does that mean you should use it on spinning disks? Mm-hmm. I feel like, especially in the context given here, if you have a spinning disk and it's connected to like a NAS, don't use any Mac file system. Use BTRFS, EXT4, use ZFS, use something else better suited to that task, because then you can just SMB mount it on your Mac and it will be fine. There's a reason we wanted to get away from HFS Plus. Despite the fact that it is very efficient for spinning disks as compared to APFS, it is not a great file system. It doesn't have lots of file system features that you might want, especially for something like a NAS. Other file systems are better there. My personal choice, even when I had spinning disks, you know, in the age of APFS, I would format all my spinning disks as APFS. It would make them slower. Like, there's no doubt about it, it would. But normally what I was keeping on those disks was, like, large files and other stuff where the performance doesn't really matter because it just boils down to sequential speed, which is the same. It should be the same in both of them, or close anyway. I just took the speed hit because I was sick of problems with HFS Plus, and I wanted the reliability of APFS despite the performance. So my recommendation, I think it is still relevant for people who want to make that trade-off. Like, if you decide, no, I can't stand how slow this is, I have tons of small files, HFS is so much faster on a spinning disk, I'm just going to do that. But only do that if you're forced to directly connect a disk to your Mac and you can't stand the speed hit of APFS and you're okay with running disk utility every once in a while to repair errors, or you don't care about errors or whatever. In all other cases, either use APFS on spinning disks and just take the hit, or if anything, if at all possible and you're in a NAS-like scenario, don't use any Apple file system. Use a good file system that is supported by your NAS.
Leon Cowell writes, when discussing John's new app, he briefly mentioned the many aspects of files to consider, metadata, extended attributes, ACLs, etc. Would you mind expanding a bit on that? How will your tool handle that as it deletes a file and then replaces it with a copy-on-write clone? What metadata, if any, is preserved or lost? What metadata, if any, is considered in determining whether two files are identical?
Take the second question first. What do you care about when determining whether files are identical? Literally, the only thing you care about is the content of the file, the data. All that other stuff is not in the decision-making process. All that other stuff can and will be wildly different between two files. All you care is this data the same? Because the data is the thing that you're going to be sharing. That's the thing you're going to have one instance of, whereas before you had multiple instances of. Everything else is private and will remain private to each individual file with no sharing whatsoever. So when I'm wandering the disk trying to say, is this file the same as that one? I'm looking at the data. I also look at the resource fork, which technically I don't think I have to do, but I'm just doing out of habit. And honestly, how many people still have resource forks? I'm pretty sure the resource fork doesn't matter, but why? You know, I just, better safe than sorry. So for two files to be considered identical, they must have the same data fork and the same resource fork, even though the resource fork is accessed through an extended attribute, blah, blah, blah. But setting that aside, nobody has resource forks. Not a big deal. Although apparently I do, because I have all these ancient files on my from like old Mac game, classic Mac games, and my buried in my games folders. Anyway, so that's how you decide two files are the same. Once you've decided that two files have the same data in them and you're going to do a space-saving clone, yeah, the job you have to perform is, okay, make a clone. So it's sharing all the data with whatever the original file was or whatever. And then the file that you're getting rid of and replacing with the clone, you've got to copy all of that metadata to the new replacement file. And I try to copy all of it. Every extended attribute, every permission thing, obviously the file name, all the file dates, so on and so forth. It's not actually possible to, on a modern macOS, to copy all of it. Some things, for example, the file system sort of maintains on its own. And you can call APIs that supposedly set it, like things like the last open time, last access time. There are APIs for changing that, and you can call them, and they'll return success. And the file system will be like, yeah, nah, I've got that covered. Because it's like, you're trying to tell me the last time this file was accessed was sometime in the past, but you just accessed it, man. And so it just doesn't do it, which is fine. Like, most of the time people don't care about that. And honestly, it is true. Like, this file was just accessed right now. I did it. Like, I accessed it, right? And so even though the APIs for setting that return success and there is no error, most of the time the file system will ignore you. Other things you literally can't set at all. Like there's a bunch of extended attributes that Apple doesn't really document well that do various things. If I can't set those, it's an error and I can't say reclaim the space. Like I tried to set all the ones that I can set, but if there are ones that are meaningful that I can't set, like literally can't, especially ones that I don't really know, like it's like the binary blob of stuff that I don't understand, my app will throw up its hand and say, look, I tried to save your space on this one, but I couldn't set the com.apple.macl extended attribute. Sometimes it lets me. Sometimes it doesn't. I don't know why. Some extended attributes are, in fact, protected by system integrity protection. If it's one of those and I can't override it, man. Like, you know, another thing is, this is a sandboxed Mac app. There is no way that I've been able to find to have any sort of like, why don't you just ask me to authenticate as an admin user and then your app can do anything? I don't think you can put an app in the Mac App Store that does that. Even though I'm sure there are ones that are there, I think they're sort of like leftovers from when Apple used to allow that. But right now, I don't think they do. So again, in future versions, I might have an unsandboxed helper app to help out with this. But right now, if, for example, you want to reclaim space used by a file that you do not own, you can't do that because my app can't set the owner back to whatever it really is, right? So that's part of the metadata. Like, oh, I've made a space-saving clone. Now all I got to do is make this file look like the one it's replacing. And the one it's replacing is owned by, somebody who's not me. Well, you can't CH own a file to somebody who's not you when you're running as you. And there's no way for me to ask for an administrator password to do that or whatever. So again, if I cannot get the metadata to match to the best of my ability what I think is the stuff that it needs to match, I'll show an error and say I couldn't do that for you. Or in many cases, if I know I won't be able to do it, I'll just skip over it and not include it in one of the eligible files. Like, so if I see a file is owned by another user, I'm just skipping that or whatever. There are some that I will let go by. So for example, if I can't set some date thing, like the last access date, the fact that I can't set that, I'm fine with that. Like, but honestly, because I would never be able to clone a file if people insisted that date stay the same. Because I am accessing it. It is truthful that date should be updated to be the date that I did my thing. So I set it and then I forget it. Like I do set it. And if the setting call returns an error, I would cause an error, but it always returns success. And so I continue on my merry way. So yeah, I'm making best possible effort for a Mac sandboxed app. Nothing that any user really cares about should ever be missing. And if it is, my app should bail out and say I couldn't do this file and move on to the next one.
All right. Thank you to our sponsor this week, HelloFresh. And thanks to our members who support us directly. You can join us at atp.fm/join. One of the many membership perks is ATP Overtime. This is our weekly bonus topic. So members get an additional bonus topic every week, runs usually like 15 to 30 minutes more. You can get that at atp.fm/join. This week on Overtime, we're going to be talking about iOS 19 UI rumors and how that relates to Apple invites. So if you want to hear that, once again, atp.fm/join. Thank you so much, everybody, and we'll talk to you next week. I have been doing so much restaurant stuff.
Are you in Inferno right now?
I assume it's a reference. I'm not kidding.
Dante's Inferno.
Oh,
I didn't get it either. But that was a much better joke than either of us gave you credit for.
I was thinking the coupling direction, which is a very different thing. all right. So anyway, yeah. So I did ask last week. I had mentioned that I discovered this, or I had known about this audio technology called Dante that allowed you to route audio signals over the network. I had never really used it, and last week I had discovered that I can indeed use it for some of the needs at the restaurant. Basically, like, you know, certain, like, you know, DJ input area is very far away from the amps and mixer and control areas and stuff like that. So, and then the subwoofers are really far away from everything else. And so how do we link everything up? And the way it's been done so far is with a large quantity of very old and unreliable cables that are snaked around the entire restaurant, collecting dust and looking bad. And so anyway, I was seeking to reduce some of this cable clutter and simplify certain things, make things more reliable and less reliance on very long analog cables snaked behind God knows what. So anyway, Dante is, I haven't actually had a chance to set up Dante yet, but I have all the hardware. I have a bunch of the little tiny, like, they're dongles. They're like XLR ports with network ports on the other side, and you just like plug them into the network, and there you have XLR in or out. I have a handful of those. We got a lot of feedback from people who are familiar with Dante or who use it professionally.
It's kind of like if we had been listening to a podcast and someone on the, if we three had been listening to a podcast and the person on the podcast said, "Yeah, I've been trying to do this project and someone told me about this thing called Linux." And like it's like a different kind of operating system that you might be able to use in this application. So I'm going to look into that. Like we got the feedback like that about Dante. It's like the whole world except for us knew about Dante. And once you mentioned it, they came out of the woodwork and it's like, yes, a million people who use Dante for a living listen to this show. And you're going to hear, but it's like saying, have you heard of this thing called Linux? I don't know, it's some kind of other, it's not Windows. It's not the Mac. Interesting. I'm going to look into that for next week.
Yeah, so... the feedback was pretty universally two types of feedback. There was one that was from people who said, I learned about Dante, not I use it, that's separate. I learned about Dante through some way, and you really should have a totally physically separate network for it. And then the other group of feedback was, I actually use Dante professionally, and this will be fine on your network. So thank you to everybody who responded. Again, I haven't had a chance to actually install it yet. There was a bunch of wiring that had to happen over my last few visits there. But I'm looking forward to trying it probably next week. I don't know if it'll be in time for next week's show, but I'll see. Anyway, I have been going back. Now, you know, the feedback we got suggested that, yes, it's very dependent on, obviously, like, your network speeds, your network switching architecture, and how, you know, do you switch to support QoS, or do you want to isolate Dante onto its own VLAN and prioritize that VLAN? So I've been doing a bunch of research on, you know, which of these things I should do, how do I do that? The good thing is I am using all Ubiquiti gear, and all brand new Ubiquiti gear, and I thought... This would be a really good opportunity to try something I haven't done before. I am now, in that one context, partially living the 10 gigabit Ethernet lifestyle.
Oh, my word.
I'm not sure your restaurant needs that kind of bandwidth.
So what everyone said with Dante was like, you know, you just got to make sure that your network doesn't get clogged up with other stuff. And we have a gigabit internet connection. The internet connection is used for, you know, there's going to be like wireless terminals here and there. I'm sure that's not much bandwidth, but still wireless terminals for the POS, the little walk around handhelds. There's going to be, you know, the TV streaming over the Wi-Fi or over the Ethernet rather, but over the network. There's going to be, you know, there's Wi-Fi around. I have a guest network for the Wi-Fi, but I have it right now limited in Ubiquiti settings to 100 megabits total. I don't know if I'll keep that there, but just for now. But I'm like, you know, the way the wiring is routed through the restaurant, the signals for Dante, in order to get from one location, like from basically from the DJ plugin to the speakers and the mixer and everything, it has to go through two switches. And I'm like, well, what's the latency of Ethernet between switches that are, you know, well-performing switches? Like, does 10 gigabit Ethernet actually have substantially lower latency than 1 gigabit Ethernet? Or does it just run like more in parallel? And I did some quick ChatGPT research, and apparently 10 gig Ethernet has way lower latency because it is just running the whole protocol just runs at faster data rates. So I'm like, well, if my goal is to have lots of headroom and to reduce latency, and I have all of this, like, you know, modern ability. I have the ability to run modern Cat 6A wires just as easily as I'm going to run Cat 6 wires. Why don't I just run really good wires and spend the few hundred bucks on Ubiquiti's store to get a 10 gig switch for those two long runs? So not everything is to. Oh, and then the other thing. This is the other thing that made the decision easier. A couple of years ago, Ubiquiti came out with a switch called the Flex. This is a little 5-port switch. These are the ones that I have on the outside of my house running the security cameras and outdoor APs because they are indoor-outdoor rated, John. And I've had them now running very well for, I think, 2 years? Perfectly well. And they're these little tiny, like, they're... What makes them great is that they are indoor-outdoor rated. They are powered by PoE. And also will then re-output PoE to their other four ports. And they're really cheap. They're like $100 or a three-pack for like $280. So like a little under $100 for a three-pack. So I've used these flex switches. I've used them all over the place at home and different uses. They recently came out with the Flex 2.5G PoE switch, which is only $200. It's 8 ports. Its input is 10 gig, and its outputs are all 2.5 gig. And all across the Ubiquiti line, 2.5 gig is all of a sudden everywhere. Like, everything supports 2.5 gig. So I'm like, well, I'm getting faster, and if I just use that switch instead of the regular Flex, then I get 10 gig back to a home switch. So I got the one, they have a like 5-port 10 gig or a 4-port 10 gig switch for a few $100. And they have the Flex 2.5 PoE for $200 each. And I just needed two of them. And so now I have basically like all the other, like most devices will be plugged into a 2.5 gig port. I know they're not going to use it mostly, but they will have that port. But then from switch to switch, that's running 10 gig. So for the two long legs where it's going like across the whole restaurant to a switch and then back again to a different part of the restaurant, those like trunk legs of it are 10 gig. And it's glorious. Like it's like I wired everything up today and like, and I mean, this is the wiring process alone has been, as I mentioned last time, like very, very demanding. Like, I'm like crawling around on top of walk-in fridges, like crawling through an attic space to like run different wires, drilling lots of holes that, you know, with varying degrees of success. I had to fish a couple of wires through, like there was like, you know, a wall, like a wall with like, you know, thin walls and then a gap between. And I had to go like from one side of the wall to the other, both of them through holes. So I'm going through like, you know, hole, gap, hole. How do I get two Ethernet wires through this? I'm looking around. I had at my house over there, I had like one of those like wire fish things, and I could not find it for the life of me. So I go back to the restaurant. I'm like, what the heck could I possibly use at the restaurant? And I find there is this like this metal, like the kind of little tiny flagpole that like when you see somebody decorating their lawn for the 4th of July with a row of little tiny American flags stuck in the ground, one of those. And I'm like, If I just zip tie the Ethernet cables to the stick of this, I can stick it through the wall and line it up with the other one and pull it through. Like, that's the kind of, and by the way, that worked great, and I've done it 3 times. That's the kind of thing that I've been doing the last week or so at the restaurant. But it has been very, very fun. And now I have everything wired up. I have my 10 gig backhaul trunk links. I have my 2.5 gigs at the two major points of devices. I have all the APs. I have 3 APs installed. I think that'll probably end up being enough. If not, there's an easy place to put a 4th one. Everything is Ubiquiti. Everything is so nice and so easy and so freaking fast. So far it's going very, very well. And thank you, everyone, for all the Dante feedback and everything else. And hopefully Dante running on a 10 gig backhaul should be plenty for what's probably going to end up being something like 4 channels or 6 channels of actual Dante usage.
I had a question in the chat room of, is this Wi-Fi only for the employees or is it for the patrons as well?
I think it will mostly be used by the employees because it's not like a coffee shop. It's not like the kind of place people would bring a laptop and come work. It's a bar and a restaurant. Like, so it would be like no one's sitting there with a laptop all day. Like it's generally going to be for employees' phones, I think, when they're bored and it's slow. And then separately, again, the walk around POS terminals. But those, I created a private network and I don't intend to give that password out to anybody, including the employees. the private network has, you know, full access to the network. I'm going to put the PoE walk around hand or the POS walk around handheld things on that network. And then what I'm going to actually give the employees if they want to connect their phone for whatever reason will be the guest network. And because that way, like, it limits everything. It keeps, you know, then I don't have to worry about, like, them giving out our private network password to someone else and then someone else being able to come in and, like, control our mixer or whatever. Like, that's a terrible idea. So I'm going to try to keep those things separate. And then if I need to, so there is a, there's already a VLAN for the guest mode of the access points. If I need to create a second VLAN for the Dante stuff, I can. But I don't know if I need that level of complexity, because I assume that all of these modern Ubiquiti switches support the proper QoS tagging of the packets and everything to probably not need that. But we'll find out.
You know, the way you're describing your backhaul between the basically front of house and back of house, that's what I was planning on doing here when I was still, I mean, I still am fantasizing about like fiber and whatnot, but if I actually do it, is unlikely, more unlikely with each passing moment, especially as I get distracted with all things Home Assistant. But anyway, my thought was I would have like fiber to go from the garage, which would be, you know, kind of sort of the command center, and then flow up to the upstairs and into, you know, some sort of like switch in the attic. And then I would probably bring fiber into the office, but everywhere else would just get probably gigabit Ethernet, maybe not even 10 gig Ethernet, because nowhere else really needs it except the office and wherever, you know, like the Synology ends up, for example. So it's a very similar approach to what I was talking or thinking about doing. Now, at the time I was thinking about doing it, I would argue that 10 gig Ethernet was far less common. And the thought was I would be forever future-proofing by having fiber, which I know is not quite that simple, but for the sake of this conversation, that was the thought. But I haven't acted on any of this, and I am unlikely to unless, you know, Stephen Hackett comes to visit and wires the house with me. So we'll see what happens.
I mean, the thing is, like, faster than gigabit Internet connections are starting to become available in the U.S.,
Yeah.
Like that, like, and many of the, I think the latest Wi-Fi 7 stuff, I think the reason why Ubiquiti is putting 2.5 ports on a lot of their switches now, I think is because some of their access points have 2.5 ports. Because Wi-Fi is getting so fast that I think at maximum capacity, some of these, you know, high-end enterprise APs can actually exceed 1 gigabit. So I think it is worth considering, it is worth planning for a faster than gigabit infrastructure when you're putting network stuff in. But that being said, like, you can get 2.5 over regular, I think even Cat 5e might do it. And certainly Cat 6 would do it. Like, you don't even, like, a Cat 6a can do everything. So, like, there's, you don't need too crazy of, like, a wiring setup to have very high speeds, especially if your distances are short. Like, I think regular Cat 6, I think, can even do 10 gig below something like, you know, 100 feet or something like that. So, like, it is worth considering all these things if you're putting new wiring in, but you don't need to go too nuts with some of this stuff because you can get by with more than you think. Like you can get a lot faster on regular cables than you think.
Setting aside the Finder's terrible interface to local file sharing in macOS these days, I actually was looking into both 2.5 and 10 gig solely so the two computers that are 5 feet away from each other in this room that both have 10 gig Ethernet ports on them could talk to each other at 10 gig. My internet is still 1 gig. So instead, rather than having like a Marco's situation where he's got like the backbone of the network being 10 gig and then it's branching out, I would have the backbone of the network being 1 gig. But just in this room, these two computers that both have 10 gig Ethernet ports, they should be able to talk to each other over 10 gig. And we get, you know, 12 feet of cable, and I don't even think I need to replace cables. Like you said, Marco, the ones I have would probably do it. But when I started looking at the prices of like a 4 or 5 port 10 gig switch, or, you know, even like one with like 10 gig upstream port and then 2.5 between, it was getting pretty pricey. I'm like, I hope this will come down over time. So I what I'm probably going to do is just do nothing and then wait until the day when 10 gig is either 2.5 gig is my internet connection, in which case I'll just replace everything from end to end with at least 2.5 gig, because that would be worthwhile. Or when 10 gig becomes cheaper. But I am looking in that direction. Like, again, because like I always buy computers with 10 gig ports on them, and every time I have to wait for some large file to transfer from, or even like even just the Synology, I don't think know if my Synology actually has a 10 gig port, but a new Synology that I bought, I would be sure to make sure it had one for future proofing. I do wait for file transfers, and when I'm waiting for them, I start thinking to myself, like you said, Marco, like, would this be faster over Wi-Fi 7? than the wires that I'm using, given that these two computers are can see each other. But yeah, the march of technology comes with infrastructure costs.
Yeah, and to be clear, like I can't imagine a situation where this network at the restaurant is going to actually use 10 gig speeds between anything. Like it's only going to have one computer. It's
how
not
many tracks of audio would
files.
That require? How many tracks of like 192 kilohertz like audio right. of like, you know, high resolution that nobody can hear the difference? You probably need thousands upon thousands of those tracks being transferred simultaneously. To
yeah, like at least, you know, CD quality 44.1, which I haven't configured yet, but I assume I'm given those kind of options, is 1.5 megabits. Yeah. So
you get a lot of those streams in yeah. 10 gigabits.
Yeah. But yeah, like I don't intend to actually need that kind of like transfer. My goal is like I want nothing to ever drop out ever. And so yes, obviously a physically separate network would probably do a better job of that, but I don't want to run twice as many cables and twice as many switches everywhere. Like I want the one network that I know will have so much headroom at every possible link that nothing will ever get bogged down and make my audio drop or make my TV frames drop. Like, the internet connection might, that's a separate thing. But, like, I don't want the audio to start cutting out, you know, at midnight when a DJ is playing on a Saturday night. Like, that's not something I want to happen. And so to have a whole bunch of headroom everywhere, I think will allow that. Especially because, again, it was a difference of a few hundred dollars at most for, like, total for all of it. So I'm very happy with that.
All right, titles.
Let's see. I think my favorites are No Longer Airy Good and Not the Glory Speaker.
I think we might have used Not the Glory Speaker before, because I'm sure I've used that phrase before.
What was the Glory Speaker about?
It's the center channel. It's not the Glory Speaker.
Yes. I think I like No Longer Airy Good, but I'm open to other ideas.
Yeah, I'm good with that.
I wonder if the E should be lowercase.
Oh, maybe.
If you can endure a week of people telling us that there's a typo in our title.
I think I can, because then they're all wrong.
I mean, and plus, like, it's in the pre-show, so like they're going to get it pretty quickly.
People send emails the second they notice something wrong.
Oh, you're right.
They send out the feed. I think they were trying to write the word very, but they forgot the V. Casey must have had a typo in the CMS. I should send them an email before I start this episode.
So true.
Yeah, it is funny to think, like, who's going to get blamed most? I bet you're right. I bet it'll be Casey.
Yep.
But we'll all have to read the email. And if you make it a capital E, you'll probably get less of the email, but I'm not sure if the joke is better.
I think it's better with it lowercase.
People can blame me. It's fine.
All right, let's do it.
I think that's what we're going to go with that. No longer lower E good, airy good.
All right, so many emails. I'm signing up for some email.
Yeah, we are.
I mean, it'll be, you know, better than...
Well, here's the other problem. In Marco's typical sort of deadpan delivery, the joke delivered that explains this is missable. Like, you know what I mean? It's in the show. It's right there. But, like, I feel like Marco should preemptively make an Overcast clip with the joke in it that he can send to the 500 people who do not hear the joke and still insist that we have missed the V in the title.
Well, you know what? Let them think that. It's fine.
All right. Yeah, anyway, that's the title.
All right. Thank you, live people. We're going to cut you off now and go to the bootleg for overtime. And we'll see you next week.